Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to An Hour of Mind Power. Well, today we are going to be talking about a real unique book. This book, it is a novel, but there is such a fascinating twist to it that if you really wanted to read something that's going to make your mind work a bit over time, this book, Entangled, is one that I think could be very, very fascinating to you, but also thought-provoking. My guest is Graham Hancock. I want to welcome you to the show, Graham. And where are you right now? We're talking to you overseas, but what country are you in?
Hi, good to be with you. Well, I'm in England, and I'm in the city of Bath, which is about 100 miles west of London, down here in the southwest of England.
Graham, your book really intrigued me as I was reading it. It was intriguing to me because you have taken a concept that deals with parallel dimensions and time frames that are thousands of years apart. I almost felt like I was in a Star Trek special, but we didn't have any spacesuits. And it just, the costuming was very different. I was really intrigued with it. In fact, I have to be honest, when I started to read this, I got to go, oh, no, don't give me this stuff. Okay. But I've learned, because so many times I'm surprised when people have unique twists in their books. The curiosity I had about your characters made me want to find out more. Graham, you're a man that has written books about all kinds of subjects. You're the author of Fingerprints of the Gods. You have done historical mysteries. Let's deal with that aspect. What is it that, as a writer, made you go into that genre?
Well, I've been writing nonfiction books. All my books until now have been big nonfiction studies. And back in the 1980s, before I got at all involved in ancient mysteries, I was writing nonfiction books back then, but they were on very different subjects. I mean, for example, I wrote a book about foreign aid, a very critical book about foreign aid called Lords of Poverty, which studied the lifestyles of those who get rich on foreign aid. Mm-hmm. And I was very much a current affairs man. I was a journalist. I was the East Africa correspondent for The Economist. But by a series of accidents in my life, I got drawn into the mystery of the past, and I began to realize that the very ancient past is an intriguing area for investigation, that really historians and archaeologists don't know a whole lot about what happened before 5,000 years ago. And even in the last 5,000 years, the interpretations of history are often extremely sketchy and really no much better than a fairy story. And I thought it was useful to apply my investigative skills to mysteries from the past rather than from current affairs issues. So around about the end of the 1980s, I completely shifted direction, and I wrote my first big non-fiction book, which was called The Sign and the Seal, A Quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant, and which looked at Ethiopia's claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant. And then I went on from there to write Fingerprints of the Gods, which is certainly my best-known book. It sold about 5 million copies around the world. It was enormously popular in the 1990s, and it made the case for a lost civilization that there could have been a huge forgotten episode in human history brought to an end by the cataclysm at the end of the last ice age. And I thoroughly documented this possibility and went into myths and traditions and looked at the mysteries of some of the archaeological sites around the world which rightly attract controversy, such as the pyramids and the Great Sphinx of, mm-hmm. of Giza. I just felt that there was so much about the past that was mysterious and unexplained that it couldn't safely be left to the archaeologists and the historians alone, that some other perspective had to be brought to this story. And so I spent a great deal of time doing that and writing these detailed investigations. But I reached a point within the last 5 or 6 years where I really felt that I had done that, that I had devoted decades of my life to exploring historical mysteries in a non-fiction writing, thoroughly documented, detailed, argumentative style, supported by footnotes, dealing with facts, albeit putting a different interpretation on those facts. And I began to yearn for a new mode of expression that I would still be dealing with extraordinary ideas, but that I would shift in the direction of imaginative fiction as a vehicle to explore those ideas.
Many authors that enjoy historical facts like you do and are of the investigative nature, it has been my observation that they frequently want to shift into a fictitious format because they feel they can plant the seeds in the mind of the reader of other options of thinking, perception of possibilities that are different from what they have been taught perhaps in school. And it's an amazing thing. The art of storytelling always is that enables us to reach the minds of others when we can...
It's a kind of telepathy.
Yes, it cloaks truth in a way that is palatable.
Yeah, that's right. When you present work as nonfiction, particularly if you're dealing with startling or extraordinary ideas, as I have done for many decades now, you immediately find yourself up against a massive academic establishment. I've spent a lot of the last 20 years in debates and arguments with archaeologists and Egyptologists about the nature of history and about my reading and my interpretation of history. And it's inevitably the case when you are presenting information as factual information that you have to be able to defend it, and you have mm-hmm. to be able to get to grips with the critics who are going to attack you. And what I found over many, many years was that this required me more and more to bulletproof my argument with a whole architecture of facts, just constantly anticipating where the next academic critic would come from and what weakness in my argument he or she would attempt to exploit in order to discredit my work, and therefore bulletproofing my argument at every point. And this resulted in books that just got longer and longer and longer. And mm-hmm. my style of writing, I felt, over the period of time, became more and more defensive because of the need to deal at a factual level with critics. And I don't like being a defensive writer. I like being on the offensive. And that's certainly how I was when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods back in 1995. At that case, at that time, I didn't care what mm-hmm. the academic critics thought. But I discovered with the storm of controversy that book unleashed that I did need to care what they thought in future books that I wrote. And it was really a desire to put an end to that defensive posture, to not to need to bulletproof every argument with huge structures of facts, but rather to write in a free-flowing way while exploring extraordinary ideas that drew me towards fiction. But with fiction, it's really clear in my mind that the first and the most important responsibility of the novelist is to tell a fast-moving story, a story where the characters are interesting to the reader, where you want to know what happens to them. So action, pace, plot, story are the most important issues. And the ideas then become secondary. They're the framework against which the story unfolds, if you see what I mean. But it has to be a story mm-hmm. first and foremost. It has to be a good story. The reader is not going to give their time to a story that does not compel them. That's the first thing I knew that I had to do as a novelist was draw the readers in.
Well, you did that, and you did it with me, and I know you will do it with thousands, if not millions, of other people as well. But you really have gone into a time zone factor that is extremely interesting because you are using a Stone Age setting, and then you're using a modern age setting. So chapters alternate. And the reader has, you challenge the reader's thinking processes because the reader has to shift from one time frame into another time frame. And then there is this fascinating interaction that you bring out. But let's talk a little bit about the fact that you did a lot of research background. Of course, you've already talked about what you have done in your professional area of writing in the nonfiction genre, but you get into neuropsychology, consciousness, quantum physics, shamanism, yeah. and paleoanthropology, and yeah. this...
Entangled is Entangled indeed covers and ventures into all of those areas. Into areas that some readers might find very mysterious and very strange.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right that the two principal characters in Entangled
mm-hmm.
Live at opposite ends of history.
Mm-hmm.
They're both young women, troubled young women, and one of them lives in modern Los Angeles in the 21st century. And the other lives 24,000 years ago in the Stone Age in northern Spain. And the whole view of time that is expressed in this novel is not that time is an arrow or a straight line that goes from past through present to future, but more that time is like a knotted ball of string where supposedly different time periods intersect and cross one another, and that in a sense all times that we think of in a linear fashion are in fact unfolding simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible from that perspective for these two young women to be in contact with one another, and they are brought together by supernatural forces, by an angelic being that I call the Blue Angel. She
mm-hmm.
brings them together across the time barrier to do battle with a demon who travels through time. And that demon is active in the Stone Age 24,000 years ago, in the time of Rhea, the young Stone Age heroine of my story. And he has taken a human body, and he is misleading human beings into acts of violence and wickedness and evil, because this demon gains power with every act of wickedness that he can mislead human beings to carry out. And the ultimate act of wickedness that he's trying to make human beings commit is the extermination of the very last Neanderthals, our cousins, the Neanderthals, who did disappear, this is a fact, from the archaeological record very mysteriously 24,000 years ago. And in my story, the demon Sulpa is misleading human beings to exterminate the Neanderthals, because if he can persuade them to do that, then he will gain a sufficient psychic charge to leap across the ages and manifest physically in the 21st century and weave the doom of all mankind. and the supernatural being who's trying to stop him, the Blue Angel, although very powerful in spiritual realms, cannot intervene directly in the material realm of human beings on Earth. The only way that she can intervene is by influencing human consciousness. So she chooses these two young women, one from 24,000 years ago and one from today, to be her heroes, to be the ones who will take the battle to the demon and his forces and defeat them and prevent them from misleading mankind down this terrible dark path. And the way that these two young women get in contact with one another, and this is one of the things that's controversial about the novel, is through not through some kind of time machine, but through altered states of consciousness, using visionary substances that shamans in tribal and hunter-gatherer societies have used for tens of thousands of years, whether it's psilocybin mushrooms in the case of Rhea, the Stone Age character, or whether it's ayahuasca, the vine of souls, the visionary brew of the Amazon, which the young modern heroine is able to use in order to make contact with her sister in time 24,000 years ago in the past. The notion is that once our consciousness can be separated from the body and can float free, then it can travel through time and space at will. And that the key to this, as I said, is not a time machine, but simply altering our state of consciousness so that we no longer remain bound to the material realm.
I find it so interesting that people like yourself are writing material that emphasizes the role of the female, which represents the intuitive, creative side, overpowering and learning how to flex muscles, make decisions, and not be afraid to fight.
Absolutely.
To go against the established patriarchal positioning. I'm also intrigued with the fact that I'm finding, in my observation, that more men are writing these kinds of stories than necessarily women.
Yeah.
Now, it's not that women don't, but it's as if there is actually an awakening that is being expressed by many men saying what we have done isn't working, folks. And when you listen to what the news was talking about today, you have a conflict in Korea, you have things that are going on. I was reviewing material this morning about Honduras that just was grieving me deeply when I read it. There was just this painfulness that I was feeling. I thought, what does it take to break things that no longer, they haven't worked for such a long time? What does it take? And it really takes a meeting of consciousness mindfully that enables individuals, not necessarily a mass, but individuals to lead by example, and then those that are capable of seeing will see, and then the change starts to evolve. Mankind has been going through this cycle so many times, it's not even funny. Your book, though, the portrayal, especially of the young woman, in today's 21st century, speaks so loudly to a lot of what the younger generation is experiencing, and that is a sense of disconnect, and it's as if you have picked up on the need for a connection, a need for purpose, a need for values, a need for living life with an essence to create something that is real, that's healthy, that is absolutely going to contribute to the betterment of life. And I'm just intrigued with all of these subtleties that go through your material.
Well, thank you. I knew from the very beginning that the divine feminine was going to be a crucial motif of this story. And by the way, the story itself came to me in a most extraordinary fashion, because I mentioned the visionary brew of the Amazon called ayahuasca, which means the vine of souls, which has been used in the Amazon for thousands of years by shamans as a portal to project their consciousness into spirit worlds. I was in Brazil in 2006, and over a period of 2 weeks, I had five ayahuasca sessions. And during these sessions, I effectively downloaded, as a kind of inspiration, almost as a kind of channeling, all of the essential details of the story that became entangled, and most prominently and most forcefully, that the heroes of this story would be young women, and that the story would show the courage and resolve, as well as the love and beauty of these young women. And I think it's not an accident, because in the Amazon, this mysterious brew, ayahuasca, is understood that it's understood that behind it lies a great intelligence. And every culture in the Amazon who works with ayahuasca knows and recognizes that this great intelligent being is female. Often she appears in visionary states in the form of a woman, and very often also as a great serpent. But always as an entity that is filled with love for humanity, but that sometimes this love is tough love, that it involves spelling out harsh truths, that it involves obliging us to confront reality, and that always it's about our responsibility for our own lives and our own choices. This is one of the most distinct and clearest messages that ayahuasca always sends, which is you must take responsibility for your actions and your choices. And coming from this inspiration, Entangled is a novel of the battle of good against evil. Again, one of the fundamental themes of human life. And as you rightly say, there is so much evil in the world today, so much blindness, so much wickedness, so much cruelty. Government agencies, huge international corporations, the military-industrial complex are all spreading a climate of hatred and fear and suspicion in the world today, so that we're forgetting that fellow human beings are fellow human beings at all, so that we get drawn into narrow nationalisms and tribal feelings of hatred for mm-hmm. other people simply to bolster the power of individual politicians, when what is really needed in the world today, needed more than anything else, needed desperately, is love. And love is giving, and it's goodness, and it's kindness, and it's generosity, and it's doing a difficult thing even though it's difficult to do. We have to break this cycle of hatred and fear and suspicion in the world today. And those, I believe, with the most power and the most wealth, those most securely grounded in their national status, should be the very first to act generously and to give love rather than hate, to give trust rather than fear and suspicion. We have to break this cycle, and so underlying Entangled is this notion of almost a cosmic battle of good against evil, and the fact that what is special about human beings, what makes us different from every other creature on this planet, is that we have the power of choice, the power to choose one path or the other, the darkness or the light, the good or the evil. We can always make that choice. No human being is prevented from making that choice. Even in the most difficult and terrible of circumstances, we can always choose for one or the other course of action. And part of the message of Entangled is that evil cannot always be defeated, but it can always be resisted. And that is the first obligation of a true human soul, I believe.
You have also characters in here called the Uglies, which
yes.
I thought was incredibly fascinating because they represent a part of the human capacity. When I was reading about them, this is inherent and just about every human being, but discovering it is really something. But you've got here the beginning of a trilogy, am I correct?
Well, it's certainly going to be two books. The first volume has just been published, and the second volume, which will complete the series, will be published next year. It's not going to be three books. It's a big story, and I found that I couldn't tell it in one book alone. And by the way, the Uglies who you speak of, they're the Neanderthals, our closest relatives who mysteriously disappeared from the historical record 24,000 years ago. I was shown in the visionary inspiration that led me to write Entangled. I was shown that the Neanderthals were not these kind of brutish, knuckle-dragging creatures that for so long we've typecast them as being. But they were filled with goodness and truth and beauty, that they communicate telepathically, not in spoken words, that they have healing powers, that they have no violence or wickedness in them. It's for this very reason that the demonic force in my story wants human beings to destroy the Neanderthals, because they're so good and because demonic forces work on the destruction of good, and it's the mission of my two young women heroes of this story to stop the demon doing that and to defend goodness and truth down the ages. And as I say, that's always a choice that human beings can make at every level. You know, we can't change the world, but we can act within our own sphere of influence. We can every day make choices for good rather than evil, and it's just a matter of making that resolve and doing it.
Graham, your book is utterly fascinating. I would like to know, what is your website where people
can go? The website is www.grahamhancock.com, and do go to the page marked Entangled. It's prominently there at the front of the site, and you can click right on it. You'll find four chapters from the novel available free to read online. There's also a video trailer about the novel and plenty of background material about the science behind the novel. And one thing I have to warn readers, there's a lot of violence in this story. It is a story of the battle of good against evil, and I felt it was essential to show evil as it really is and not soft pedal on that, but it makes for some tough reading sometimes.
Yes, it does. It's very, very realistic. If you are a person that's intrigued with a concept of time slips, parallel universes, different cultures, curious about the unique, dare to enter into an arena of thought, of history, that maybe you would never have ever even been curious to explore. This book, Entangled, will really be gripping. And Graham's website is grahamhancock.com. That's GRAHAMHANCOCK. Entangled is the book. It is amazing. So you'll want to have this, because the next one will come out next year. Graham, thank you so much. I know it's late in England. So appreciate your staying up so late to be able to spend some time with us today.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Have a marvelous evening. Rest well. And I look forward to our next time to chat.
Thank you. Wonderful to talk to you. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to be taking a break. Don't forget Graham Hancock's book, Entangled. This is the first one. You begin a journey with him that takes you into realms of thinking, battles, well, and a whole lot more than you could ever imagine. It is a winner. This is Donna Sebo. We'll be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. Give me your first name or initial, and then I'll give you some information about yourself. That's right. I'll do a psychic reading on the air for you. And then after that, you can ask me a question about anybody or anything that you may want to, well, know a little bit more about. And I wanted to let you know, tomorrow we are going to have a phenomenal horn player. His name is Skip Martin. This guy is just absolutely awesome. He has played with top musicians around the world, Elton John, Neil Diamond, you name them. I mean, he just knows them all. And he has put out his own albums, and I became acquainted with his wife on my last business trip to Las Vegas, and I didn't know anything about Skip. Wow, his music is awesome. So we're going to be hearing that tomorrow. And, of course, on Thanksgiving, we're going to be having a best of Donna, because I, like you, will be spending time with family and friends. But on Friday, we're going to be back. We're going to be back live with Mike Barra in his book, The Choice. And I think you're going to find Mike's perspectives very, very interesting. And then for the remaining part of the month, we're going to be talking about a new wrinkle. Eric Shapira is going to be my guest. And then if you're familiar with Gilligan's Island, yes, that show that's still running around on television stations, which people just love because it represents a time and a space when, well, you didn't have a lot of ugliness and violence on shows. This Gilligan's Island, we're going to find out about Maynard. That's right. We're going to find out about Maynard, the wonderful person who was Gilligan, and we'll be interviewing his wife. So we've just got a great lineup for the rest of this month, and I hope you'll be able to join me and tell your friends about it as well. Now, what I wanted to do was let all of you know something that's so very important. Of course, this is tongue-in-cheek when I'm saying it. Do you know why your hair turns gray? Well, let me tell you. Radiation. Now, it has been something that has always been of interest. There are some of us that the hair will grow in gray at a very early age. I'm sure you've known people, as I have, that had gray hair when they were teenagers, for heaven's sakes. Well, some Japanese researchers say that they think they've found what triggers gray hair. After all, that's just something all of us have to contend with, especially we women. We don't like to have the gray hairs there. That's why the hair coloring business is so very successful. Well, apparently, they have found that it's caused by radiation-induced stress. Now, what does that mean? Well, apparently, within every hair follicle, there's a population of melanocyte stern cells. Do you have a clue? I don't. I've never heard of that before. Now, these cells apparently split into two different populations. That's what they use as a description. One of these population of cells produces pigment for the hair before it dies off, while the other becomes a new stern cell. Or maybe I should say a stem cell. Not stern, but stem. Now, they say when you're in a stress-free world, these cells replenish themselves indefinitely, and we would never, well, we'd never get gray hair. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with baldness either. But stress-free, this world is not. Nor is the lab of dermatologist Ernie Nishimura at Kanazawa University. Now, she and her colleagues decided they were going to bombard brown and black-haired mice with DNA-damaging radiation. Now, the consequences, as were described in a magazine, is that the melanocytes that originally went on to rejuvenate instead only matured and died. Well, those poor little mice, they all went gray really, really fast. So they say these cells, the reason they die off, it's a way for the body to shed potentially cancerous radiation-stressed cells. So they said, whatever you do, don't blame your spouse or loved ones for your silver strands, though. Emotional stress has not yet been shown to harm these cells that are associated with the coloring of the hair. Well, I think anybody, if they are really going to think this through, will realize it's all chemistry. It's all chemistry. And there are certain things that are genetic and other things that definitely are affected by environment, weather. There's so many different things that go on. Well, until they figure out how we can keep our hair color the way we want it to be, well, guess what? We'll still be using those color rinses. Guys do it just as much as the gals. And those businesses will continue to flourish. But radiation is what, to the best of scientific knowledge at this time, what turns your hair gray. Donna Sebo here. I'm going to be sharing with you how you can take a very popular winter vegetable, acorn squash, and make it into a delicious dish. Now, what's so important about winter vegetables is that they're really loaded with nutrition. But when you look at a lot of these squash, if you are like I used to be, you'd look at them, sort of hit them with your knuckles and go, gee, that's interesting. What am I going to do with that? Well, let me give you some tips that you can utilize that'll enable you to actually, if whether you're a vegetarian or not, it doesn't make any difference, enjoy this wonderful, healthy batch of vegetables that are going to keep you strong and healthy during the winter months. You know, in our world today, we are so fortunate because year-round, dependent on where it's being brought in from, you can literally have tomatoes all year round. You can have kale and other things that are very nutrient-rich if they're grown in the right environments. Well, your winter vegetables really are special, and they're your squashes, not just things like kale and collard. These are very hardy vegetables. So if in your local environment you can fraternize your local farmers' markets and get these vegetables from your own area, that's a very, very good thing to do. One, you're supporting your local business, your local farmer, but two, you are living in that environment, and it enables you to work better physically. So this is so very important. So if you've got a pad of paper and a pen handy, I will just give you this real simple recipe. All you have to do, let's say it's acorn squash, you just cut it in half, and they are tough, so you need a real sharp knife. You cut it in half, scoop out the seeds and the pulp from the middle. You want to brush them with butter. You can use olive oil if you want, but to me, the butter just really adds a wonderful, wonderful flavor. And you can sprinkle it, if you want, with sugar and a little bit of salt, or you can use maple syrup. Maple syrup just has a flavor that is unparalleled, the real stuff. Not the artificial syrups, but the real maple syrup. And you can also use honey if you like. Now, you do need to bake your squash in a 400-degree oven, needs to be preheated, of course, for an hour, or dependent on the size of the squash, sometimes they get to be pretty big. So it might take a little bit longer in the baking. But if you find that the top of your squash is beginning to get a little dark, you don't want it to burn, then just cover it with some foil. That's all you have to do, and then it won't do that. Same thing you do with pies, okay? So if you're having to bake it longer, it needs to be so tender that you put a fork in it, and it's just going to go right in very, very easily. And it is absolutely delicious. And I'll tell you something else you can do with it if you like. You can fill it, if you want, with dressing. And you can have it flavored. There's just so many different things you can do with squash, but it's just delicious with salt, pepper, and a little bit of butter. If you want that sweetness, a little bit of maple syrup or honey will just add magic to it. So that is something that you can have. It's healthy. It's filling. It's going to help your immune system, and you're going to find that it's absolutely a delight and a pleasure to eat. And you know what? It's good for your waistline, too. It's not going to pack the pounds on you. It really is wonderful to add to your dietary regimen. Donna Sebo here. I've got a very special story that I'm going to share with you. And to me, it makes sort of like a nice Thanksgiving story. And the reason I feel that it does, it's about a woman that's in my area. She's in Tacoma, Washington. And her son, well, she had to give him up when she was a teenager. No, not a teenager. Excuse me. I stand corrected. She was 21 years old. She was an unwed mother. So I'm going to be sharing her story with you after we come back from break. But before we go on to break, I wanted to share something with you about lights. Now, I don't know about you, but here in the Pacific Northwest, we don't have a whole bunch of daylight. And as the winter months are very, very dark here, it is important that you have something like full spectrum lighting. The more lighting you have that gives you that natural color spectrum, the more comfortable you're going to be. And women are affected frequently more often by this, not having full spectrum lighting in their environment because their hormones are affected by the darker hours. And having been traveling up to Alaska for so many years, typically, for example, up in that part of the country, the population is younger. Most of the population is, between their 30s and maybe mid-40s, up to upper 40s. And then they start leaving. The reason is there are these hormonal changes that occur, and most people do not do well with the long months of darkness and the extreme cold that they can experience. It's very depressing for them. Well, when you bring in full-spectrum lighting, that makes a difference. And now lights have advanced to such a degree that the LED lights are becoming very, very popular, and they are energy efficient as well. But it's just absolutely wonderful what we're able to bring into our space. So be sure you check out how you want to illuminate your space. And that'll keep you from getting depressed, as so many people do during the winter months. And also remember to have lighter colors in your environment if you can possibly do that. And I know especially after the holidays are finished, you know, everything is put away and all the brightness of the holiday decorations are tucked away. And then we go back to what seemingly is a monotonous period where there's an anxiousness about getting past winter. Well, that's very normal. That's something that we all are going to experience to a degree, unless we live in a place like Sunday, California, or Hawaii, or Florida. Then you may not feel that. But regardless, with the winter months, be aware. You want to be in a bright, happy environment. Make sure you have things around you that make you feel good. And your LED lights, they're really getting better and better. And I think as research and the more sophistication we have with utilizing energy, we're going to find that there's ways and methods that we can create our living environment so instead of being oppressive and making us feel like we're very, very confined, as often it is in the northern part of the country, we can feel much different. Donna Sebo here. When I come back, we're going to be talking about a very special woman's story and how she finds a son she never really knew. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be right back.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Oh, I wanted to remind you, those of you that are listening from Western Washington, I want you to know that I'm going to be doing a special appearance at a wonderful event. It's coming up on December the 11th, and that is the Dickens Fair. Now, this is going into, I believe, its fifth year. I will be appearing at the King's Bookstore in downtown Tacoma, and I'll be doing many readings there. So put it on your calendar. It's a Saturday. It's a fabulous way to get involved with your family and friends, having a wonderful, crisp winter day to enjoy carriage rides, hot cider, wonderful conversations with different people, and all kinds of activities during the day. I believe it starts as early as 10 a.m. in the morning and will be going on until 6 with special plays and everything else. So look it up on the web, Dickens Fair, Tacoma, Washington, and you'll get all of the details. And again, I'll be making an appearance at King's Bookstore from 11 until 4, and part of the proceeds will be donated to a charity that's being supported by the event. I wanted to share a story with you about a woman that is in my local area. And Patty is the name of the lady. And when I heard her story, I just thought, wow, this is really significant. So I wanted to share it with you. Now, when she was 21 years of age, she found that she was pregnant. As so often happens with these kinds of situations, there will be those in your life that will absolutely want to throw you on the garbage heap. Well, her father was furious. He said, "We will not have a baby in this family that was born out of wedlock." So she was trying to figure out ways that she could keep her baby, but financially she just wasn't in a position to do so, and she felt that the child she was going to give birth to needed to have a family that really, really wanted to have him. And she, before she gave her baby up, she said to him, "I've always loved you. I always will. And when the social worker took her baby, now she wasn't a 14 or 15-year-old. She was a 21-year-old. She felt like her life had been ripped in a way that could never be repaired. Well, eventually she got married and ended up getting pregnant, and she had a miscarriage. Then her husband got killed in a car accident. She remarries. That marriage ends in divorce. Patty was feeling very, very alone. And every Mother's Day, when there'd be a big celebration with all of the female members of the family, she had this pain that was inside of her that she just couldn't get rid of. And it was all about the baby boy that she had given up so many years before. Now, she often would think about him. Years went by, and she said there were some ideas that popped into her head. Of course, if she did any research trying to find out about the birth family that adopted her son, doors were slammed in her face. And she said she got this idea from a job that she had where she was working for a classified department for a newspaper. So she decided she'd put in an ad, and the ad read, "Happy birthday, baby boy. I love you, your birth mom, Patty Langdon." Well, Patty did this a lot of times. After a few years, she decided to put her son's first name in. Now, keep in mind, she's in Tacoma, Washington. 65 miles away, in a community called Winlock, there is a young man. His name is Todd Smith. He had grown up on an 11-acre farm. He had all kinds of wonderful animals. He had a very, very good life. His parents loved him dearly. He's a grown man, has his own family, but he himself had always yearned to find out about his birth mother. And he was on the computer, and he was doing some searching. Now, he knew he had been born in the Tacoma General Hospital, and he knew the date, April 19th, 1967. When he typed in that information, there were 75,000 search results that came up. But the very first one that he saw read as follows. Baby boy Langdon, happy 43rd birthday. Todd, your birth mother, Patty Langdon. That blew him away. He had a chill run up and down his spine, and the question was, could this be my birth mother? So, he typed in her name, an address popped up, and he said, all I need now is to have the courage to do what I feel I need to do. Now, what evolved, Patty was about to fall asleep one evening when she heard a knock at her door. Now, she opened the door, and she sees a man holding a newspaper in his hand. He looked at her. He said, this ad matches me. I might be your son. And when she looked at him carefully, she felt like she was looking at a mirror image of herself. Well, this was their reunion. A lot of conversation happened. And Patty now found she was no longer alone. Now, what was even more special about this story is that Patty had the chance to meet Todd's adopted parents, and they had been trying to find her for years. They wanted to thank her because they had loved her son so much, and he had filled their lives with so many good things. Well, his children had an additional grandparent. And she said when she was introduced to her grandchildren, 43 years of pain just melted away. She said today she's looking forward to Thanksgiving and Christmas for the first time in over 4 decades. She said the hole I had inside me is finally gone. After all these years, I have my son back, and I never have to feel alone again. Wonderful story. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have a magnificent time wherever you are. Stay warm if you're in snow and ice like we are. Be safe. We'll talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.